All right. Let's continue. That was Proposition 6, the repeal of the vehicle fee increases and the gas tax. Proposition 7 authorizes the California legislature to provide for permanent daylight saving time, but it would only happen if the federal government were to allow that. So this is a dependent proposition, so to speak. Katie, you want to start us on this one?
Well, as a relatively new mom, I feel like
it makes you an expert on
Yeah, the fewer time changes, the better. But I think you really laid it out. This is something that I feel like California has sort of had a fascination with. We saw it, there was a bill in the legislature this year and that allows for this vote. But you really laid it out. What does this proposition do? Not much. I mean, it lets the legislature vote on it. If the legislature approves it, the governor could, then it lets Congress work on it. And I believe the president has to weigh in as well. So, I mean, it's just, it is the start of a step of a process, but it really isn't anything that you'll see happen anytime soon.
Anybody else with anything quick to add? Michael?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think that this is we're already a couple steps in. As I recall the history of this, I believe that there have been the legislature's been interested in this in the past, and we're now at a point where they were waiting to see if other states were going to be interested in moving away from daylight savings time. And so I think the legislature's kind of hopeful that by getting the California voters to weigh in on this one and then they will act, that maybe that will lead to a larger group of states getting behind this effort.
And part of the challenge is our California Constitution, which is hundreds of pages long. We continue to put a lot of things in there, and this was decades ago that we did this. And so now we actually have to have you vote on it to allow the legislature and Congress to take action if it happens. So we're just asking you not to just give them permission in case there's a national trend to change this. By the way, the European Union and throughout the world, there's major discussion, and in Europe, they will change it next year, that we're getting rid of this. And it's consistent throughout the world, and we just want to continue with it.
There are concerns, historically, I should say, there have been concerns in the agricultural community about this, and because of, you know, the darkness when kids would be going to school, things like that. But Katie, are you aware of any sort of organized opposition to full-time daylight saving time?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that would be interesting to see if it gets out of California and goes to the federal government. Where would everyone come down on it? I honestly don't know. I do know, I will say, I used to live in Indiana, which had 3 time zones and was incredibly confusing. So we wouldn't be as bad as some places. But I don't know how the federal government would take to this.
Yeah, of course, our neighbor Arizona doesn't go on daylight saving time, so they have a permanent permanent time, but it's not daylight saving time, it's a standard time that they keep year round. So once again, that is Proposition 7, which if passed by voters, then would allow the legislature and the governor to take this up if the federal government were to make a move towards standardizing full-time daylight saving time. Proposition 8 would require dialysis clinics, kidney dialysis clinics, to issue refunds to private insurance companies for revenue that they take in that's more than 15% profit from the service that they provide. This is a very complicated measure. I've just led recently a full-on debate on this, and I'm still trying to get my head around the complexities of this. But part of the history is the effort of Service Employees International Union to organize the employees at the 2 biggest dialysis companies, the chains that are here in California. Michael, you want to start us off on this
so
one?
You gave me the hardest one.
I was going to say,
Actually, you know, this one is...
I've known you the longest, I think. That's why I'm punishing you.
My evaluation of this is exactly what you just said, which is this one's incredibly complicated. I've waded through this a number of times, and it reads as if it's an attempt to again lower the cost or make dialysis treatment more affordable, but I do understand that there's a little bit of politics behind it, which I wonder if some of my colleagues might want to talk about, because I'm not quite as aware of the politics.
Melody, do you have some info on this to share?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the lesser known initiatives. No doubt you've heard the radio ads, because $120 million is being spent on this.
A lot of ads,
mostly by the dialysis clinics who have poured a lot of money. You know, you do have the backdrop of unionizing, and you have the backdrop of, you know, whether or not healthcare costs should be able to soar like they have been. And so there's a lot of in the background going on to this one, on top of the fact that it's just a very complicated measure.
So the proponents, their argument is that there would be a greater investment by these dialysis centers in patient care because they're not going to want to pay these rebates to the private insurers for going above 15%. And since what they would pay their employees in the providing the services would count as expenses, that therefore they would be more likely to invest in that. Opponents say this might well lead to dialysis clinic closures. We'll continue on this proposition on our voter cram session. This is the 2018 voter cram session heard on public radio stations throughout California. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Pasadena. We're at KPCC's Crawford Family Forum. This hour is devoted to looking at the pros and cons of California's 11 ballot measures. We're taking these in numerical order. Again, in case you joined us right in the middle of this broadcast, you can visit the website kpcc.org, and you'll be able to click on the link and hear the entirety of the broadcast. Also, if you'd like to take part in social media conversation around any of the ballot measures that we're talking about in this broadcast, please just use the hashtag CADREAM. That stands for California Dream, CA Dream, which is the collaboration of nonprofit news organizations, public radio stations in the state, and of Cal Matters. Let me reintroduce our panelists joining us from the Southern California News Group, which publishes a variety of newspapers in Southern California, the interim opinion editor, Salvador Rodriguez. Also from the San Francisco Chronicle, political reporter Melody Gutierrez, Caltech professor of political science Michael Alvarez, Loyola Marymount professor of political science Fernando Guerra, and KQED San Francisco politics reporter Katie Orr. We were just talking going into our break about Proposition 8, which requires private insurers be given rebates by dialysis centers if they go more than 15% above their direct costs for providing patient care for kidney dialysis. Now, the price is much, much lower for those who are in Medicare. This really targets the reimbursements that private insurers are making. Fernando?
Yes, again, very complicated. There's a lot that I like in this initiative. There's a lot that I hate in this initiative. It's basically two interest groups who couldn't resolve this issue in their private negotiations. They took it to the state legislature. They couldn't resolve it there, so now they're bringing it to you, except that they are giving you emotional arguments, not all the facts, because it is very complicated, and it is somewhat emotional. And when that happens, oftentimes we tend to vote no when we don't clearly understand it. To throw in some even more criticisms, not criticisms, but complexity is what you just mentioned, Larry, that I think it actually undermines the current situation, undermines the Affordable Care Act, and this would resolve some of that because it costs so much for insurers to cover dialysis that they don't want the pre-existing condition. So it plays into all of those national politics.
Salvador, you want to share any thoughts about this Proposition 8?
Sure. So, I mean, I don't know how many people here in the room are experts on the dialysis market. Something tells me there's not very many of us.
I wouldn't be surprised if there is someone here, but go ahead.
So on the economics of the yeah. dialysis market, when you have a fight between special interest groups like this and you're talking about a proposal to regulate an industry and particular components of the industry of an industry, is that something that we really need to be doing as voters? Is that something to do? If you don't feel like you know exactly what is at stake, you probably should vote no. This is probably not what the force of law should be used for micromanaging things like this. This is an abuse of the proposition process and an abuse of law.
All right, that's Proposition 8 requiring rebates from kidney dialysis centers to private insurers if they go above 15% margin on providing that service. Proposition 9 doesn't exist anymore. It would have carved California into three separate states. And the state Supreme Court said this proposition as written is not eligible to be on the California ballot. So no proposition
but
9.
It doesn't mean we won't see it again in the future.
Oh, I'm sure we will see it again. It may not be three separate states.
Yes, okay.
Who knows how many states may be involved. So next up is Proposition 10. Now, this is the rent control measure you've heard a lot about. It repeals what's known as Costa-Hawkins, which puts limits on rent control measures that cities and counties can put on for unincorporated areas. So this means that newer construction would be covered by rent control. Melody?
Sure. One of the biggest areas that this would address is that single-family homes and condos could come under rent control. That's something that Costa-Hawkins says that cities could not pass. So this doesn't create rent control in these cities. This actually gives cities the options to expand the type of rent control that they have. Obviously, there's a backdrop of a housing market where people cannot afford to live in the communities in which they work or communities they've lived in for years. But surprisingly, it's not doing well in the polls. And I think that that's really interesting. It's not even doing well among renters. But there is an incredible heartbreaking story of people not being able to afford where they're at. But there's a lot of opposition arguments saying that if you create these availability of this kind of rent control, that essentially there won't be development, that developers will not build if they don't think that they can earn a profit.
There also is the argument that single-family homes that are in the rental market, if those are rent-controlled, then fewer people are going to be willing to rent out those houses. Let's say they inherited it from mom or dad and they turned it into a rental, that it won't be as financially advantageous for them to rent it out, so those homes would be sold, not part of the rental stock. Katie, more thoughts on this?
Well, I just think it's interesting, especially considering that it's not doing well in the polls, because when they were considering this in the legislature this year, it was one of the most contentious issues up there. I mean, supporters of repealing Costa-Hawkins flooded the halls of the Capitol chanting, and when things didn't go their way, they were very upset. So it's interesting that there's a group of people who support it very, very passionately, but apparently it's not transferring to the rest of the voters.
Fernando Guerra.
I think of this just as a local control measure. All this does, it says, we give it back to the cities. And so California right now has one law that it's one size fits all for the entire state. But what we need in Pasadena or Santa Monica is different than what we might need in Anaheim or Laguna Niguel or San Diego. This, all it does, it doesn't institute rent control at all. What it does, it gives it back to the city councils to determine on a case-by-case basis. And that's, so really, from my perspective, it's a local control. Let the locals decide what is best for their communities.
Salvador.
Yeah, so this absolutely is. It's about local control. It's about giving localities the control to be completely irrational and shoot themselves in the foot. Rent control.
Do you support that or not?
No.
So you'd rather be shot by California then?
Not quite, but rent control is a beautiful idea. The rents are too damn high, and so what better than to cap the rate of increase in rents? That's nice. Keep rents low. That's a fascinating idea. You pick up an introductory economics textbook, you go to page 1. And there you will see why rent control is an absolutely absurd idea. That it will dramatically, it will significantly curtail housing production, housing affordability. It will have the opposite effect that proponents hope it will. It will be great for the people who get into rent-controlled units. It'll be horrible for the vast number of people who never are able to get into a rent control unit, who are never able to get into a new apartment or a new home that they can afford because the landlord pulled it from the market, or they converted it to a condo, or they did all kinds of different things to adjust.
Isn't this, though, similar to the argument over Prop 13 and particularly the proposition here, 5, in that there would be potentially fewer limits, if you accept that premise, fewer units that would be built. But for those individuals who might find themselves out on the street or would have to move a tremendous distance from their job or lose their job, that they would be protected. So if you make the argument that Prop 13 is good for older Californians because they're not displaced, why wouldn't that argument hold for rent control here?
So it'll be great for the people who are able to get, who are in a rent control unit that is not then converted into a condo, or the people who are able to get into a rent controlled unit that was built, or get into a unit that was built and that is affordable. But we're not, so there's the seen and the unseen in every policy decision. What we'll see are the people who are in rent-controlled units. What we won't see are all the homes that are not built. We're not going to see all the units that are not put on the market. We're not going to see, we're not going to see the market work like it should. Now, obviously, we want to see people be able to afford to live in California. The way to do that is not to impose artificial limits like through rent control. Instead, let's try to facilitate more housing construction, more housing development, not do artificial games like this. Just open an economics textbook, look at page 1.
Sal is right about the economics textbooks and what it says, but I hate to pick on my economic colleague because they're actually worse at prediction than we political scientists. And so everything that's written in economics books.
Which is saying something.
So it's not really an economic issue. It's what Larry was talking about. It could be a social justice issue and what kind of state we want to live in.
All right, Michael?
I'll go back to where I was talking about with respect to Props 1 and Props 2. I mean, what we're seeing here, I think, on the ballot, think about the ballot as a totality, is a lot of different efforts to try to grapple with this crisis of affordability in California. Here we're seeing an attempt to stabilize rents. In Props 1 and 2, we're seeing an effort to, probably put a few drops in the bucket of trying to build more housing to try to deal with the supply side of the problem. So we clearly need to grapple with it on both sides. Stabilization, I see, is a really good short-term fix if cities want to move in that direction, but they really do need to be careful about how they do it and try to balance it with building more supply.
All right, let's move on and talk about Proposition 11. This would allow the status quo where private ambulance drivers, emergency medical technicians would be able to be on call when they're taking their meals or other breaks. Because as I understand it, and our experts will correct me if I've got this wrong, but it seems under new state law, new interpretation, potentially they could not be on call with the change in interpretation of state law. This would enable them to be on call. Katie, you want to start on this one?
Sure. And right, like you were saying, in 2016, the Supreme Court ruled that private security guards, when they were on a break, they were on a break. They couldn't be on call or anything like that. And so the ambulance, primarily the private ambulance industry, saw this and decided that they felt like it's only a matter of time before a similar ruling is applied to them. So they're trying to get out ahead of this, basically carve out a piece of the labor law saying that their employees can still receive calls while they are on breaks. It's similar to Prop 8 in that it's a really specific industry issue.
And why wouldn't they be able to lobby the legislature to carry this through? I'm curious this ends up as an initiative.
They tried. That's what happened,
legislature,
right?
They tried.
They went through the legislature, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's a private dispute. They didn't solve it privately. They took it to the legislature. They didn't solve it there. Now they're asking you to do it. Mm-hmm. And so now remember, why do we even have private ambulance drivers? It's because a lot of cities, not like Pasadena or Los Angeles, where we have our own paramedics, they contract out. And so our paramedics here in Pasadena or Los Angeles don't fall under this. They can be on call because they're public safety officers. But in cities that contract these ambulance services, those EMTs and ambulance drivers are not considered public safety. Even though they're doing exactly the same job, it's because they're from the private sector. That creates a challenge.
Well, and I'm curious why the legislature, there wouldn't be sympathetic members of the legislature who would carry it on behalf of the private ambulance industry. It's interesting that didn't go anywhere.
Well, you might have, labor groups might be opposed to that. You know, if you're carving out
slippery slope.
Right, and if you're carving out a part of the labor law, it might not get far.
That's a logical argument that they'd be concerned. Well, if they deal with ambulance drivers, then who might be next? That's Proposition 11. And are labor unions, do you know, Melody, have they come out against this or not? I I don't think I've seen...
For some odd reason, I know that the California Teachers Association is against this.
Really?
Why? I don't know. I just read that somewhere.
That's good. Teachers are always on call, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's Proposition 11. The final measure on your California ballot is Proposition 12. Supporters of 12 say it is a natural extension of Proposition 2, which was passed a decade ago and put new space requirements on egg-laying hens, on pork, as well as on calves that are being raised for veal. And they say, the proponents of it, that this guarantees even more space for those animals than was in Proposition 2. The opponents of Proposition 2 say this is largely the work of a major egg supplier in California's Central Valley, and that they actually want to have smaller cages in which to have the egg-laying hens. Melody, do you want to start us on Prop 12?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a ballot measure that you would normally think that animal welfare groups would all jump on board, and they're not. And the argument is that the amount of space currently under law for says that an egg-laying hen has to be able to stand up, turn around, and lay down. Now, what does that constitute? Like, what is the exact specs of that cage in which a hen can do that, or a breeding pig, or a calf? And so this ballot measure essentially is creating those specs, but animal welfare groups like PETA say, well, you know, we don't agree with that space, and that was never the intention of voters to give them that little of space. And so Humane Society says this is good. PETA and some other groups also say that are saying that this is going to give them actually less room, and that you would be doing more for animals by not voting for this.
So, and you have major environmental groups, Sierra Club's in favor of this, and I believe the Natural Resources mm-hmm. Defense Council. But as you say, animal welfare organizations, there is a split. The Humane Society of the U.S., one of the big sponsors of this, as they were of Proposition 2, which was passed by California voters. Katie, anything to add on this?
Well, I think it's one of those examples when it is a tricky measure. You know, I mean, you see this and you think, oh, you know, I feel like animals should have space. But then you get into the intricacies, and I think that's a lot of times the problem we have with governing by proposition, right? You don't know all the details that you really need to know.
Sal, your thoughts on Prop 12.
Yeah, so we're in a situation here with Prop 12 where the animal welfare groups can't decide if this actually enhances animal welfare. You have some that say yes, you have others that say you have like PETA, that's very strongly against it. I would just humbly recommend that if there's a measure on the ballot that you can't wrap your head around, that even animal welfare groups, they can't decide if this actually enhances animal welfare, perhaps vote no. Perhaps this can be resolved another way. Perhaps we can have a more deliberative process rather than have something as convoluted as this.
Well, I have to say, for all of us on the panel, I think, you know, all of us get asked a lot by friends and family members, what about this ballot proposition? What about that one? And so often, I'm just speaking for myself, I don't know about the rest of you, I have to say, you know, I've read about it, I've hosted debates on it, I've immersed myself on it, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around all the different moving pieces to it.
Yeah, Larry,
so many of these
are complicated.
You
should do what I do. I just tell every other person yes or no, and that way it balances out.
It's randomized.
And
yeah.
Then you don't sack the deck. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate, on this statewide broadcast, we appreciate your joining us. For our 2018 Voter Cram Session, our panelists, Loyola Marymount, Professor of Political Science, Fernando Guerra, KQED Politics reporter, Katie Orr, Southern California News Group Interim Opinion Editor Salvador Rodriguez, San Francisco Chronicle Political Reporter Melody Gutierrez, and Caltech Professor Political Science Michael Alvarez. The 2018 Voter Cram Session is part of the California Dream Project, a statewide media collaboration of KPBS, KQED, KPCC, Capital Public Radio, and the nonprofit news organization Cal Matters. The project gets support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the James Irvine Foundation. Keep the discussion going on Twitter. Use the hashtag CADREAM for California Dream. For the 2018 Voter Cram Session, I'm Larry Mantle of KPCC, Los Angeles.